fellas. Thank you.
All right. What a great week it's been. What a great week. Let me say thank you to our four team captains. They've done a great job this week, haven't they? All of our staff and faculty who have jumped in and gotten involved, and we sure appreciate that. Thank you to my team and the activities department that have helped do so much work to make Spirit Week happen this week. Thank you to Brother Douglas for allowing us to have Spirit Week. We, you know, we spend this whole week divided up in four teams, and whether you're a freshman, a sophomore, or a junior, or a senior. But tomorrow, we combine together into one team. And that team could be an unstoppable force that could take this Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland area by storm with the gospel of Jesus Christ tomorrow. In the end of the day, we are not just freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors. At the end of the day, we are Hiles Anderson College. At the end of the day, we're together, unified in a team to fight the devil and to charge hell, not with a squirt gun, but with a fire hose. With a fire hose of the gospel of Jesus Christ to try to reach every single person we possibly can with that gospel. And I'm so very proud of you. Some of you have come out of yourselves this week. Some of you stayed on the hill. But most of you didn't. And I'm so very proud of you, and I'm excited about what this week will do to springboard us into the remainder of the semester in the spirit of our college, in the spirit of our student body, in the spirit of our staff and faculty, and the spirit of our Hiles Anderson family. You know, Hiles Anderson College was started in 1972. It was not started on this property. It was started where Baptist City is now. A couple years later, we moved here to this property, and it's no, you know, secret that we have old buildings and we have old faculty. But Hiles Anderson College is not buildings. Hiles Anderson College is not classrooms. Hiles Anderson College is not this room we're sitting in right here. It's certainly not your dorm room or the dining hall. Hiles Anderson College is you. Hiles Anderson College is us. It's the people. It's the spirit that makes Hiles Anderson College what it is. It's you that make Hiles Anderson College what it is. And so the spirit that we've generated this week, let me encourage you to carry that and continue it throughout the remainder of the semester and throughout the remainder of your time here at Hiles Anderson College. In just a few short years, freshmen, I would like to see every single one of you sitting over here where the seniors are. But you're not going to do that by accident. You're going to have to make a conscious decision to do that. And sophomores, next year, the junior class should be that big or bigger. As you continue around this cycle and through this cycle of Hiles Anderson College in preparing you and training you to serve God full-time for the rest of your life, God's business truly is the greatest business in all the world. And I'm so excited that you have chosen to be a part of that. You know, in this room today, well, by the way, open your Bibles. We are going to use the Bible today. We're going to end up in Matthew chapter 26, but we're going to start in Matthew chapter 4. And I'm going to take a long time to lay a foundation today and then get to the sermon at some point before 1 o'clock. But represented in this room today are 159 different churches in our student body. The 380 students that are enrolled in Hiles Anderson College this semester came from 159 different churches. And each church is unique, different sizes, different personalities, different spirits, different states, different countries, different continents in many cases. So I did a little bit of digging, and through my experience of having traveled to several churches in the past years with tour, I would imagine that in this room, the 159 churches that are represented, the average size of your youth group — now, some youth groups are large. If you're from First Baptist, you're from a large youth group. Some youth groups are small. Some of you, you were the only person in your youth group last year. And so the average size, from what I can gather, is the average size youth group in our country would be about 15 teenagers. Some bigger, some smaller. So I took that number 15 and multiplied it times 159 and came up with 2,385 teenagers from your churches on average from a student body this size. And I was thinking about that number as I was reading through and preparing for the sermon today and looking at the journey that Jesus took throughout the book of Matthew and the journey that his disciples went on. You know, we read the story of Jesus' birth in the beginning of Matthew, and it's not as detailed as it is in Luke, but the beginning of Jesus' ministry and how Jesus was baptized of John the Baptist and the Holy Spirit came down, and then Jesus was tempted of the devil, and three times he said, "Get thee behind me, Satan," and Jesus overcame that temptation. And then that brings us to where we are here in Matthew chapter 4. After all that happened, in verse 12 of Matthew chapter 4, Jesus heard that John was cast into prison, and so he departed into Galilee, leaving Nazareth. He came and dwelt in Capernaum, and we go on. And it's during that time that Jesus was living in Capernaum, in Galilee, that Jesus recruited, if you will, his first two disciples. Now, there were many, many people that knew about Jesus at this point. John the Baptist had been preaching about the Messiah and had been preaching about the coming of the Lord for years. And so people knew about Jesus and they knew he was coming. But it was here in Matthew chapter 4 that we see Jesus actually recruit his first disciples. In verse 18, Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brethren, Simon called Peter and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishers. He said unto them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And they straightway left their nets and followed him. I find that statement there, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men," the kind of a theme statement for Jesus' whole ministry. He didn't say, "Follow me and I will make you be fishers of men." He's not going to make them do anything. Jesus said, "Follow me and I will invest in you. I will build you. I will teach you. I will prepare you. I will give you the tools you need. I will get you ready so you know how to be fishers of men." Jesus' whole ministry on earth was investing and serving and loving other people. Jesus truly led by being a servant leader. This was the beginning of that right here, where we see Jesus recruits these first two disciples. And then they go on, and Jesus' ministry begins. Andrew and Simon Peter, they didn't have to be convinced to follow Jesus. They didn't have to have their arm twisted behind their back. Jesus didn't say, "Follow me or else." They left their nets, they left their profession, and they followed Jesus. They desired to be a disciple of Jesus. And as Jesus' ministry goes on and he recruits more and more disciples, and then at the beginning of chapter 5 we see, and seeing the multitudes, now we have a different group of people. We have the multitudes. The multitudes was a group of people who flocked to Jesus. There was many of them. I don't know how many. Perhaps it could have been the number 2,385. The multitude, the group of people that we say will be represented by the average youth groups in this room, 2,385. The multitude is a group of people who desires to see what Jesus will do. They want something from Jesus. The multitude was the group of people that went to Jesus and asked him to heal their sick whoever, or to raise their whoever from the dead, or they had an illness themselves and they went to Jesus and wanted something from him. They wanted to see him perform his miracles. They wanted something from Jesus. That's the multitude. And the multitudes thronged him. We see it multiple times throughout the New Testament where the multitudes are there. Everywhere Jesus goes, it's the multitude of people that are flocking around him that want something from Jesus. So the multitudes were there in chapter 5. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. Now here's a different group of people. The multitudes was the amount of this massive number of people, maybe 2,385, who wanted something from Jesus. They were there because they wanted to see the show, they wanted to see what he would do, or they needed something from him. Jesus saw that multitude of people and for whatever reason removed himself from that group of people. Maybe they were draining him, maybe he was frustrated by them, maybe, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, Jesus removed himself from the multitude and he went up to the mountain to get away from them. And when he was there, then the disciples came. Now, this is a different group of people. The disciples are a group of people who wanted to do something for Jesus. The multitude wanted something from him. The disciples wanted to do something for him. By definition, a disciple is a follower, someone who adheres to the doctrines of another, a learner, a scholar, one who receives instruction from another. Jesus' disciples. This was, I don't know how many people, maybe 380. The multitude, 2,385. I don't know how many disciples there were that went up to the mountain with him that day. Perhaps there was 380. 380 people who truly wanted to serve Jesus. 380 people that were willing to walk away from their nets, walk away from their families, walk away from their homes, walk away from their comfort zone, to take them to the mountain because they truly wanted to serve Jesus. They truly wanted to provide for him. They wanted to learn from him. They wanted to be a part of his ministry. They wanted to serve him. So the disciples are now, I don't know how many there were. I'm going to guess maybe 380. Who separated themselves from the multitude because they had a true desire to serve God. So now they're on the mountain. And this is where we see Jesus, well, we read about Jesus delivering, teaching, preaching what we know as the Sermon on the Mount. So here they are, chapter 5, and seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. When he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, and this begins what I believe is the greatest sermon ever preached, the Sermon on the Mount. And he begins to teach them. He begins to preach to them. He begins to instruct them, this group of disciples. This sermon was not meant for the multitudes. This sermon was not meant for the people who wanted something from Jesus. This sermon was meant for the people who wanted to do something for Jesus, who had a burning in their heart to serve him, who had a desire to be in the ministry, who had a desire to serve God with their entire lives so much so that they would walk away from everything to serve him. So he began to preach this sermon. We won't go through the whole thing, all three chapters today, but it starts with what we know as the Beatitudes, and then Jesus tells them and instructs them that you're supposed to be the salt of the earth, and you're supposed to be the light of the world, and you're supposed to let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. I believe as Jesus is teaching these disciples and preaching to them and giving them these instructions in the Sermon on the Mount, that Jesus knew exactly what he was doing with this group of people. He tells them in chapter number 5, verse 17, he says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy. See, they were still living under the law at this point because Jesus hadn't died. He hadn't shed his blood. And so they were still living under the law from the Old Testament. Jesus said, I'm not coming to destroy the law. I'm not coming to wipe away all those things, but to fulfill the law, he said. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law until all be fulfilled. I'm not doing away with all those things that you're doing right now, because it's not time for that yet. It's not until that's fulfilled. He said, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. And whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. And verse 21 is where it starts getting real. up to this point in Jesus' sermon was kind of like the introduction. This is where he was, you know, kind of being easy on them. Because now is where he starts to, if you will, separate the men from the boys. He said in verse 21, ye have heard, as if this is what the law says. You've been taught, you've been told. You have heard, as that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. And whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Jesus said, this is the law. This is what the multitudes do. The multitudes, they don't kill. But you're my disciples. And I'm going to hold you to a higher standard. The multitudes, they don't kill people. But I'm telling you, if you're going to be my disciples, don't even get angry without a cause. Or you'll be in the same danger as if you killed somebody. Jesus is taking it to a whole nother level. He's telling his disciples that if you really truly want to follow me, you really truly want to be my disciple, this is what a disciple is going to do. This is what a disciple does. He said in verse 27, ye have heard that it was said of them by old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery already in his heart. The multitudes know you're not supposed to commit adultery, but you're my disciples. And I'm holding you to a higher standard. Everybody knows that you're not supposed to commit adultery. That's written in the law. But we're going to take it one step farther. Jesus said, they know that, but you, the 380 disciples who are wanting to follow me, who are wanting to serve me, I'm telling you, don't even look on a woman and lust after her in her heart, in your heart, or you are just as guilty as the adulterer. Jesus said in verse 31, it hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery. Jesus said, we're going to take this one step farther. We could debate this topic all day, and I won't take time to do that, except just to point out, the multitudes know, but you're going to take it one step farther, because you are my disciples. Verse 33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is the footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And he goes on about that, and Jesus says, listen, you know because of the law that you're not supposed to swear. But I'm not supposed to swear thyself, but thou shalt say unto the Lord thine oaths. But I'm telling you, don't swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, nor by Jerusalem. Neither swear thou by thy head, because thou canst make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for what is more than these cometh evil. Jesus is saying, be honest. Yes, no. Answer your questions, fulfill your promises, do what you say you're going to do. Verse 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. You're my disciples. For you, you're not to live under the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth rule anymore. If you truly want to follow me, if somebody does you wrong, turn the other cheek. Taking it one step farther. Verse 43, ye have heard that hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Love your enemies. Can you imagine what they must have been thinking? Love your enemies. This is a nation, a group of people who have grown up in wars. You read the Old Testament, it's war after war after war after war. And these people have experienced that throughout their entire history. And now Jesus is coming and he's saying, listen, you've been taught in the law that you're supposed to love your neighbor. But it's easy to love your neighbor. Anybody can love their neighbor. But you're my disciples. And if you want to serve me, and you want to take it one step farther in being a servant of Jesus Christ, I'm telling you, not only love your neighbors, who it's easy to love, but love your enemies, who it's a lot harder to love. One step farther. Jesus is preparing this group of people. He goes on through the Sermon on the Mount. For time's sake, I won't go through the whole thing, but he talks about giving, and he talks about alms, and he talks about treasures in heaven, and he talks about following after him, and he says, don't worry about tomorrow, I'll take care of everything you do, and he goes through and the whole Sermon on the Mount, and then we come to the end of chapter number 7, and it came to pass, when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority, not as the scribes. And then chapter 8, and when he was come down from the mountain, what happened? There were the multitudes again. So here's this group of disciples who Jesus just spent, I don't know how long, I've spent about 15 minutes just going over one little portion. I don't know how long he spent with them, but they were there for a while. When he came down from the mountain, there were the multitudes again. And everywhere he went, there were multitudes. And there were multitudes there that needed their servant healed. And there were multitudes there that needed the leper healed. And there were multitudes there that needed their mother-in-law healed. And there were multitudes there who needed their children raised from the dead. And then they were on a boat and out in a storm. And there were people there who needed Jesus to calm the storm. And then they came down to the south side of the Sea of Galilee, to Gadara. And we know the story of the maniac of Gadara. And there's a man there who is possessed of the devil, and he needed Jesus to do something, and Jesus, just one person after another, says he went throughout all of Galilee healing all manner of sickness and disease throughout all Galilee, and all these people needing something from Jesus. And then Jesus, in the end of chapter 9, in verse 35, and Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he'd been with them a lot. The multitudes were everywhere. And I don't know if at this point the multitudes started to overwhelm him. I don't know if Jesus started to realize that it's time for the disciples to step up. When Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Then he said unto his disciples, the harvest is truly plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into his harvest. This is the interesting thing about this passage of scripture right here. Jesus sees the multitude. He understands their needs. He understands that they're a group of people that need to be ministered to. He's got his disciples there. He says, all right, disciples, it's time for us to do something about this. He says, pray for laborers to go into the harvest. And then what was the next thing Jesus did at the beginning of chapter 10? And when he had called unto him his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. 12. I believe there may have been 380 disciples on that mountain that day. And I just choose that number because that's how many students we have in our school this semester. Who separated themselves from the multitude of 2,385 because they wanted to follow Jesus. And those 380 people saw and heard Jesus teach them the Sermon on the Mount and instructing them that this is what the multitudes do, but you're my disciples, so you're going to take it a little bit farther. You're going to be a better example. You're going to live a little better than the rest of the people. You're going to serve me a little bit more. You're going to be a little bit more faithful than they are. You're going to take your Christianity to the next step, to the next level. And now he said, okay, fellas, look at the multitudes out there. Now it's time for us to do something about it. So of that 380 group of disciples, Jesus chose 12. There were many called. We just used the number 380 because it fits our situation today. There were many called, but there were only a few chosen. I believe that in the time from chapter 7, when Jesus finished the Sermon on the Mount and went all over Galilee, healing all manner of sickness and disease, doing that himself with his disciples with him, watching him, learning from him. I believe Jesus paid attention to those disciples and watched and paid attention to how they were carrying themselves. And there were 12 of them who did what he told them to do in the Sermon on the Mount. And so now there's a few that have been chosen. And this is the first time in the Bible we hear the word apostle. Now, the names, verse 2 of chapter 10, the names of the 12 apostles are these. An apostle is a person deputized to execute some important business. The names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the publican, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Labius, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him, which hasn't happened yet, but will, and obviously when Matthew wrote this, it was after that happened. These 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles and into any of the cities of the Samaritans, enter ye not, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as ye go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely ye have received, freely give. And Jesus goes on for the rest of the chapter and gives them instructions and gives them power. This is a group of people. An apostle is, now we've got the multitudes who want to watch Jesus and who need something from him. We have disciples who want to serve Jesus and want to be part of his ministry. And now we have apostles who want to be like Jesus and have been given the opportunity and the power given to them by Jesus to do the things that they have seen Jesus do all this time since they became disciples. And now these guys have the power to do that. And for the next several chapters, we read about how disciples themselves cast out devils and healed the sick and raised the dead, and how the disciples, or the apostles rather, were given the power by Jesus himself because they chose to live above the rest and to live their lives more dedicated, more holy, more separated, more consecrated, more sanctified. And Jesus saw that, and there were many people called, but only few of them were chosen to do something great and mighty and amazing that no other human being had ever done before. So for the example, 380 disciples, 12 of them were chosen by Jesus to do something amazing. These disciples now went through Israel as Jesus commanded them and served him and represented him and went in his stead. Jesus went his way. They went their way. Took the story of Jesus all over Israel. Healed the sick. Raised the dead. Did amazing things. All of them did. Even Judas. Now we come to chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26. Jesus goes to the house of Simon the leper. There came unto him, verse 7, a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment, and poured it on his head as he sat at meat. The alabaster box that Mary had would have been very precious, very expensive, very priceless, very special to her. Something that, and if you were here a couple years ago, you heard Brother Doug Fisher preach a message on this platform about the alabaster box that just completely turned my world upside down in regards to worshiping Jesus. The best message on worship I've ever heard. I would encourage you to go to our website and listen to it. Sincerely. She took that alabaster box, something that was very important to her, something she'd saved up for, something that had been saved and precious for her entire life, and she gave it as a worship to Jesus, a sacrifice to Jesus, as a way to show him that he's special and important, and to worship him with that alabaster box when she broke it at his feet and washed his feet, and the disciples could smell it, and they knew the spikenard was inside, and that was a recognizable smell, and some of the disciples got frustrated about it, and you know the story, and you can read it. For time's sake, we won't. But while all of this is taking place, one of those disciples who had been given the power from Jesus Christ to be like him on earth, and to represent him on earth, one of the 12, verse 14, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests and said unto them, "What will ye give me? And I will deliver him unto you." And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. And from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. Judas was part of the multitude who decided that he wanted to follow Jesus and became a disciple. Judas was there at the Sermon on the Mount. Judas was there when Jesus healed the maniac of Gadara. Judas was there when Jesus calmed the storm, and Judas was there when Peter and Jesus walked on water, and Judas was there when Jesus fed the 5,000. Judas was there when Jesus said, "Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest." And Judas was one of the 12 chosen ones that Jesus chose to carry out his work. Now, obviously, Jesus knew what was going on. He's all-knowing. But Judas was one of those 12 apostles who had the most intimate and close relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. Closer to Jesus than any other men besides those 12 that ever walked on the face of the earth. Judas had it all. He had the power given to him by Jesus to cast out devils and to heal the sick and raise the dead. He was one of those 12 apostles. But at some point in Judas's life, he decided that he would sell out. That he would sell out his relationship with Jesus for 30 measly pieces of silver. And immediately, that relationship was broken. Immediately, Judas became a sellout in exchange for 30 pieces of silver. If there are 2,385 young people in the youth groups represented by our student body, and if there are 380 disciples in this room who truly want to serve Jesus with their life, perhaps there are 12, I think maybe more, given the quality of our students, that God himself would choose to give a very specific calling, a very specific job. Are you one of those? Does there beat within your heart today the fire, the flame, the burn that I want to represent Jesus Christ? I want to go to a city and be his ambassador. I want to go to a town and open my mouth and preach of the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. I want to reach a neighborhood with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I know that not only do I have a desire to follow Jesus and to serve Jesus, but I know that God has chosen me to do something great for him. And I just can't wait until I can graduate from Bible college so I can get out there and set the woods on fire with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Is that you this morning? Do you have that burning in your heart? Or are you maybe you're here and you're one of the disciples and you're like, "Yeah, I want to follow Jesus, but I'm not that committed." Or maybe you're one of the multitude that just kind of got caught up with the fray and you ended up here and you're like, "Well, who am I? What am I doing here? What is going on? And how do I get out?" But I believe with all my heart that sitting in this room are 380 young people who truly desire to serve Jesus for the rest of their lives. And you'll sit here today as hundreds and thousands have before you. And in your heart right now, most of you are saying, "Yeah, man, that's me. I'm going to pastor a church someday. I'm going to go start a church. I'm going to be a missionary. I'm going to be a Christian school teacher. I'm going to be a youth pastor. I'm going to be a pastor's wife. I'm going to be," and you've got it all worked out, and you've got this plan, and you're excited, and you're going to go, and you want to be that a modern day apostle, if you will, who has a specific calling, a specific, been deputized specifically to do something on behalf of God with his help somewhere in this world. And there's been many more just like you who have sat in the exact same chairs you are, but most likely about 50% of you in 10 years will not be serving God at all. Because there will come a time in your life when you say that 30 pieces of silver are more important to you than your relationship with Jesus Christ. There will be a time when you're sitting in front of a television and that movie is more important to you than your relationship with Jesus Christ. There will be a time when nobody's looking, when that button gets pushed and that website becomes more important to you than your relationship with Jesus Christ. And chances are, it has been my experience in 18 years here at the college that of the 380 of you in here that have a burning passion to serve Jesus, 50% of you 10 years from now will have sold out to something else. So I ask you this morning, what will it take? What will you take in exchange for your relationship with Jesus Christ? What will it be? You got that burning. I'm gonna pastor. I'm gonna reach people. I'm gonna minister to people. I'm gonna help people. But at some point, you're gonna have to make a decision. What will you take in exchange for your relationship with Jesus Christ? What's more valuable to you? Maybe it's a romantic walk out to the football field after dark one night with your boyfriend or girlfriend. Maybe it's a late night at work with that coworker who you just are so infatuated with. Maybe it's an inappropriate picture that is sent to you on your text message after curfew one night when you shouldn't be looking at your phone anyway. What will you take in exchange for your relationship with Jesus Christ? Judas walked around with a for sale sign. He was for sale. And they knew it. A few weeks ago, end of July, my family bought a minivan. Yes, we are old, and we are now a minivan family. We call it our swagger wagon. But we bought a minivan, and we shopped around for several months to find the right one and the right deal, and we saved up. We saved up so that when we were ready to purchase a minivan, we didn't have to go into debt. And, of course, we didn't buy a brand new one, but the Lord provided for us, and we got a very nice one for a very good price, and we were able to pay cash for it. And I bought it from the Ford dealership up the road up here, and I went in there that day and wrote out a check for the full amount, handed it to the dealer, and that minivan was sold. If I had gone back to get the key and drive that thing off the lot, and I had realized that after I had already paid for it, they had sold it to somebody else, I would have been pretty upset. I would have been pretty angry because I already paid for that minivan. I already owned that minivan. Ye are bought with a price. Instead of having a for sale sign on your life, you should have a sold sign on your life. Not for sale. You can offer me whatever you want, but I'm not for sale. I can't be bought. My relationship with Jesus Christ is more important to me than a cell phone. It's more important to me than a girlfriend. It's more important to me than a boyfriend. It's more important to me than a website. It's more important to me than Netflix or Hulu or Redbox or an internet television program. It's more important to me than a movie. My relationship with Jesus Christ is more important than a night of passion in a car on the dirt road behind the football field. My relationship with Jesus Christ is not for sale. You can offer me anything you want. I don't care what you offer me, because I am not for sale. My purity is not for sale. I'm the husband of one wife, and that's it. I keep myself away from distractions. I keep myself away from impurity on purpose. When I drive down the highway, I turn my head from the billboards on purpose. When I'm watching a ball game with my son or with my children, I turn off the commercials on purpose. When I travel to represent the college, I stay in a hotel room. If I'm in a hotel room by myself, I don't turn the television on purpose. I don't hook my computer up to the internet when I'm in a hotel room by myself on purpose. My purity is not for sale. Ask my staff. I'm not in the office with one of my staff who's opposite gender by myself on purpose. I took the door off my office and put one on with a window on purpose. My purity is not for sale. My integrity is not for sale. This building is a metal frame building. Those beams along the wall are steel K-beams that go up into the peak. You can't see them, but you can trust the integrity of those that this building has been standing for 40 years. I can't see those K-beams, but I know that they're there, and I know that they're standing. My integrity is something that you can't see, but it's not for sale. Because my integrity is determined by what I do when nobody else is looking. It's holding up the frame of the building when nobody can see it. My integrity is not for sale. What I do in the privacy of my room, or the privacy of my office, or the privacy of your dorm room, or the privacy of your car, and what you do when nobody else is looking, not for sale. My character is not for sale. My character is what you can see. I promise you this. I will give you every ounce of energy I have. As long as the Lord keeps me at Hiles Anderson College, outside of my family, you college students will get every ounce of energy that I have. I will work tirelessly for you. That's what you can see. My character, my work ethic, my dedication, my desire to pay my bills on time, my testimony in the community, how I drive my car with a Hiles Anderson placard in the window when everybody knows who you are and where you're from, how I carry myself on my bus route when my bus workers and my bus riders know who you are and know where you're from. That's your character. My character is not for sale. My testimony is not for sale. My future is not for sale. I love what I get to do at Hiles Anderson College. But I tell God on a regular basis, wherever you want me to go, whatever you want me to do, whoever you want me to be is what I want to do. My future is 100% in God's hands. I don't want to have a will. I don't want to have a way. I don't want him to know what I want. I want him to know that it's whatever he wants, because he already bought me. He already paid for me. I already belong to him. And so I have no right to sell out my future to some other cause, to some selfish thing, because it's already bought. It's already sold. It's not for sale. My relationship with Jesus Christ is not for sale. So I ask you this morning, what will it take? What will you take in exchange for your purity? What will you take in exchange for your integrity? Will 30 pieces of silver be what it takes to buy your character? What will you take in exchange for your testimony? What will you take in exchange for your future? What will you take in exchange for your relationship with Jesus Christ? Judas had it all. He was one of the 12 chosen ones. But he sold it out. What will you take? What will it cost for you to sell out your relationship with Jesus Christ? Take the whole world, but give me Jesus. We can put on a good show on the outside, but God knows your heart. Maybe you're here today and you've already taken something in exchange. You've already sold out to the devil, to the world, to your friends, to peer pressure, to the internet, to your boyfriend or girlfriend, to money. You've already sold out to something else. Maybe you're here today and you're thinking about it. And it's tempting. And it's hard. 11 disciples stayed true. Don't be a sellout. Not for sale. What will it take for you to sell out your relationship with Jesus Christ? Every day in my prayer time, every day, multiple times throughout the day, I apologize to God for stupid things I do. Because I don't ever want to give in to them. Whatever that sin is that eats away at you, I have the same flesh you do. And I don't want to give in to it. Now I may slip, and I may mess up, and I may do something stupid, but I'm so glad that the Lord hasn't given up on me yet and still convicts me for it. And I apologize, and I cry, and I ask for forgiveness, and I ask for wisdom, and I ask for strength and understanding and power to overcome it, because I don't ever want to give in. I don't ever want to be the one that goes to the world and says, hey, what will you give me in exchange for my relationship with him? Because I am not for sale. Would you put up a sold sign on your life today? Devil, you can mess with me all you want. I'm not for sale. Body, the tingling I get when I sit next to her, you can mess with me all you want, because I'm not for sale. What will you take in exchange for your relationship with Christ? Put up a sold sign. Put up a sold sign on your heart. It's not for sale. Put up a sold sign on your purity. It's not for sale. It belongs to one person and one person only on my wedding night. Not for sale. What will you take in exchange for your integrity and your character and your testimony? Not for sale.